this happened to you?
Hello, Kenneth. Would you care to accompany me to the cinema this evening?
I can't go to the movies with you, Barbie.
Well, what's the reason, Kenneth?
Gosh, Barbie, you're just too smart. I can't dominate the conversation like other guys do on their dates.
Oh, this 130 IQ of mine, it's always keeping me from having a good time. I wish there was something I could do.
Now there is. New from Rungo, VacuBrain. Use it once and you'll never need to worry about embarrassing intelligence again. 10 seconds hooked up to your left ear and you're brainless.
Hello, Ken. You want to go out? It'd be a shame to waste this adorable Friday night.
Gosh, Barbie, it's Wednesday night.
Oh, silly me. I seem to be so brainless lately.
Gee, Barbie, you're really dumb. Want to get married?
The VacuBrain from Rungo. Get it now and get dumb.
And now, we return you to the musical inner tube already in progress.
Welcome to the musical inner tube. I'm Don Rooney.
I'm John Champagne.
What is this thing? What's this podcast?
We just talk to interesting people about interesting stuff.
If you're falling into a black hole, you can't know when you cross the event horizon. There's no way to know. The laws of physics actually guarantee that there's no experiment you could do with the event horizon. There's nothing you could do that would tell you. That's like a very foundational principle of Einstein's general relativity, that the space at the event horizon is just like ordinary space. And so you just don't know that you've crossed this point of no return. And that feels so much to me like, you know, in the world, and you know, whether it's climate change or the war or whatever, it's like there are these moments where you don't know, like, have we gone too far? Can, you know, are we going to be able to get out or not?
In a recent issue of Nautilus magazine, our guest Amanda Gefter writes an essay titled "The Most Precarious Day in the Universe," in which she examines September the 1st, 1939. Now, you might know that date. It's famous for many reasons, of which Amanda focuses primarily on three. On that day, Adolf Hitler began the invasion of Europe, leading to the agonizing 6 years of the worst war of all time, World War II. On the same day, though, the science journal Physical Review published two papers that changed the way we see the universe. In one, Robert Oppenheimer, the same Robert Oppenheimer, and Hartland Snyder gave the first description of a star collapsing to a black hole. In the other, Niels Bohr and John Archibald Wheeler showed how an atomic nucleus can split, releasing a horrific energy. To paraphrase Amanda in one wonderful turn, even when human affairs fall apart, we once could rely on the solidity of reality, but these papers showed reality itself can collapse, explode, become unstable. And if you know that date at all, you may well know that W.H. Auden would write one of the greatest poems of the 20th century with that title, September the 1st, 1939. He writes of a world that lies in stupor, adding waves of anger and fear circulate over the bright and darkened lands of the earth, obsessing our private lives. The unmentionable odor of death offends the September night. Amanda Gefter, welcome back to... We've missed you for so... we've wanted to have you back since last time so much. Welcome back to the musical inner tune.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be back.
So how did you get this idea of focusing what many people would have thought are somewhat disparate events and writing a sort of a synthetic essay, joining the two of them? And I might add, it works for me, but I'm just wondering how that idea came to you.
Yeah, so Nautilus does this interesting thing, I think particularly interesting for a science magazine, where they have themed issues. And not every issue has a theme, so it's sort of the best of both worlds as a writer, because if you find something that doesn't fit a theme, you can still pitch it to Nautilus. But sometimes the editors will come to their writers and say, here's the theme we're thinking about if you have any ideas. And I find this like just really creatively freeing in a way, because I end up thinking of things I might not have thought of. So they came to me and they said, we're doing an issue on the theme of precariousness, if you have any thoughts. And I didn't at the moment, but I sort of had that in the back of my mind. And I was reading John Wheeler's autobiography, Gian's Black Holes and Quantum Foam, which he wrote with Ken Ford. And he just has this, it's sort of like an offhanded comment, but he's talking about working on nuclear fission with Niels Bohr. And he says, you know, oh, our paper came out in Physical Review on September 1st, 1939. And as it happens, it was the same issue that had this paper by Oppenheimer on gravitational collapse, but it was sort of overshadowed by the start of the war. And so I'm sort of like looking at that and I just, it gets like stuck in my head and I keep thinking about it. And I'm like, first of all, Oppenheimer doesn't get a lot of credit for that paper. It's really interesting. He's not known for his work on black holes. He's known for, you know, being the head of the Manhattan Project. And so that was, that alone was really interesting. And the explanation was like, well, black holes were a pretty esoteric thing. This paper came out the day the world fell into war. And so like nobody, the fission paper became very famous because it was ended up being very relevant to the war. The black hole paper just sort of was forgotten about. So that was interesting. But at the same time, I was like, this is really wild when you think about it, because what are those papers saying? It's one is saying space and time are no longer stable. The other saying matter is no longer stable. And this all happens on this day that the world becomes completely unstable. And I just thought to myself, you know, I had this idea of precariousness in the back of my mind. And I was like, this was like the most precarious day in the universe. And so I sent an email to my editor at Nautilus and said, you know, what if we do this? And then, of course, like I started thinking about the Auden poem and was just like, maybe there's some way to weave in the poem because it's such a beautiful thing. So, yeah.
I mean, I think along with many, many people who grew up in the Cold War years, I'm used to thinking that as soon as humankind learned how to control the explosive properties of atomic fission, we suddenly became insecure in a way that humanity had never been before. That we suddenly had, at least theoretically, the power to annihilate ourselves using tools we had invented. I think that just dovetails with the notion of precariousness that for many years during the Cold War, we felt we were on the precipice of things, didn't we?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that introduced a level of precariousness that had never really been known, because it, you know, obviously there's like many ways that humanity can destroy itself slowly, but that's one way that it can destroy itself very, very quickly. And also that you have, you know, a few people in power with their fingers on the button, and it just seems, yeah, like far too precarious for most people's comfort.
It's interesting, too, how serendipity plays a role in it, I guess. You know, for example, not too many years from then, Oppenheimer and Niels Bohr working together on the Manhattan Project, talking about splitting the atom and getting it done before the Germans get it done. So it's just interesting to me how, when you look at things like this, you start looking at coincidences that fall upon themselves and, you know, people's lives get intertwined that you never thought would.
Yeah, I mean, one of the sort of strange coincidences of the whole thing is, you know, Wheeler's on the fission paper, Oppenheimer's on the black hole paper. Oppenheimer then goes on to head the Manhattan Project using fission, and Wheeler goes on to coin the name black hole. So they didn't call it a black hole in this paper because Wheeler hadn't given it that name yet. So they just talked about completely collapsed objects or gravitational contraction, that kind of thing. And Wheeler was the one who ends up being kind of one of the key figures in developing the whole theory of black holes and how that plays into how space-time works even on the quantum scale and all of these things. So they sort of switch places in an interesting way. Like Oppenheimer never deals with black holes again. And Wheeler worked on the Manhattan Project as well, but then really turned his attention to gravitational collapse. So that was sort of a funny thing too.
Well, I was reading this essay and I had encountered those papers before in my travels and I kind of knew about them. But you draw an interesting parallel between learning about fission and learning about the collapse of stars into black holes. Both of them, there's an implied threat that both of them may maybe processes that continue in sort of horrifying ways, that black holes continue to collapse, and is there a floor, and what happens beyond the events horizon, and even light can't get out, it gets trapped, so in trying to get out, it goes back in, and there's sort of a horror element to that, that the universe is doing things it doesn't do anywhere else, but it's still following its own rules, but it seems like black holes are places where the universe really does turn in on itself. And then with fission, well, they were worried, weren't they, at Los Alamos, that who knows, we're pretty much hoping that this bomb goes off and it doesn't set everything off.
Yeah, they were worried it could ignite the atmosphere. I mean,
yeah, they were worried about a chain reaction that would take over everything.
So there's this sense of things that go on beyond, you know, that we could start something that we couldn't stop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I guess that again dovetails back to the war itself, where I'm sure there were many people who just felt helpless as it escalated and country after country fell before the Nazi advance.
Yeah, that's exactly the feeling I had thinking about all of this stuff. I mean, another sort of interesting parallel that I hadn't quite thought about until I was writing this between the fission process and the black hole process. You sort of like realize the world is kind of made of all these forces that are opposing each other. And we sort of end up in these, what feels like an equilibrium state, but is really kind of like what physicists call a metastable state, where it's like, it's stable for now.
Yes, yes. Provisionally, provisionally stable.
Yeah. And stars are that. And atoms are that. And so in a star, you have these two opposing forces. So you have the fusion in the star that is like exerting all this outward force when the star is shining. And that is enough to sort of counteract the gravitational force that's trying to pull the star together. And then in a nucleus, the nucleus is the, you know, is the little sort of center core in an atom that the electrons are orbiting around. So the nucleus is just protons and neutrons. You have this electrostatic force between the protons. So protons are positively charged, two positively charged things repel each other. And so you have this electrostatic force that's like all the protons are sort of trying to push each other apart and the nucleus is trying to sort of burst open. And at the same time, you have what they call the nuclear force, which is holding everything together. So in both cases, you have this very precarious balance. And all that has to really happen is one of those forces has to get a little bit of an edge over the other one, and you can get this chain reaction where everything suddenly falls apart. And that's what's happening in both cases. So in the star, it runs out of some of its fuel, and suddenly gravity gets the edge and gravity takes over. And in fission, when you bombard the nucleus with an extra neutron, it can sort of deform it just enough that the electrostatic force gets the edge over the nuclear force, and then the whole thing blows
everything
open.
Everything blows so, bluey. Mm.
Yeah, you just realize, like, we're just, like, on this pencil point, you know, of these balanced forces. And, you know, we like to think the world is so stable, and it's really not. And I just sort of found that to be, like, both really interesting on a physics level, but also, like, what a metaphor for how the world works and exactly what you were saying, like what was happening with the war. Because the other thing, you know, to write the piece, I went back and I was reading just a million newspaper articles from that day and the day before to try to get a sense of how people felt at the time. And of course, nobody knew the war was going to become a world war. They certainly had no sense that the Holocaust was going to happen. I mean, it was like, people knew it was bad. Obviously, Auden wrote that on that day, and he knew it was going to be bad. But it wasn't clear how bad at all.
Who could have seen?
Who could have seen? So it could have been just like a war with Poland and some allied forces came in. You know, it could have gone differently. Again, it's like, yeah, it's exactly what you're saying. Like, you know, you tip the dominoes and you don't know how far they're going to fall. And that was really interesting just to go back and sort of feel the precariousness of that moment where no one quite knows. And the other metaphor I kept thinking about with that was like when an observer crosses the event horizon, if you're falling into a black hole, you can't know when you cross the event horizon. There's no way to know. The laws of physics actually guarantee that, that there's no experiment you could do with the event horizon. There's nothing you could do that would tell you. That's like a very foundational principle of Einstein's general relativity, that the space at the event horizon is just like ordinary space. And so you just don't know that you've crossed this point of no return. And that feels so much to me like, you know, in the world and, you know, whether it's climate change or the war or whatever, it's like there are these moments where you don't know, like, have we gone too far? Can, you know, are we going to be able to get out or not?
We'll return to our podcast in just a minute. But first, here's a soothing musical interlude.
Amanda Gefter is a freelance writer specializing in fundamental physics, cosmology, cognitive science, and philosophy. Amanda's writing has been featured in The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Atlantic, Nature, Scientific American, Edge.org, The Philadelphia Inquirer, and New Scientist magazine, where she previously served as books and arts editor.
She is author of the 2014 book, Trespassing on Einstein's Lawn, and with science journalist Dan Falk, Amanda also co-hosts Book Lab, a podcast about popular science books.
Check out Amanda's website, amandagefter.com. That's AmandaGefter.com.
And now, we return you to the musical inner tube, already in progress.
It's also interesting to me how people tend to not only resist change, but actively work to back it off. I know that there were a lot of people for years, for decades after that, that argued about black holes and whether or not they were going a little too far. And, you know, gravity will never behave like this. Gravity would never fall upon itself when you think that's all that gravity does, really. Right. But, you know, I equate that to the appeasement that Neville Chamberlain and everybody else did with Hitler. Well, if we just give him Alsace-Lorraine, he'll be happy, and then we can all go about our business, and that'll be it with Mr. Hitler, and we'll never hear from him again. So it's interesting to me how a life-changing thing comes and hits you right in the face, and your first reaction instead of dealing with it is, nah, that didn't happen. Nah, that's not going to happen. Everything's fine.
Right.
We're okay.
Yeah.
We'll just keep going the way we have been.
For sure. I mean, you know, Einstein himself, when he realized that these singular solutions, where you get these singularities, where you get what looks like a black hole in his own equations, he didn't believe it. He's like, no, that can't happen. And even in the paper, the September 1st, 1939 Oppenheimer-Hartland paper, they say at the end, there must be some essential fact that we're missing that would put a stop to this. They were like, okay, we're going to describe, we realize, you know, if the star is massive enough, if it's like 20 times the mass of our sun, there's no known force that can stop it from collapsing all the way, but we must be missing something. You know, they just didn't want to believe it either. Even today, there's some physicists that still try to say that. I mean, but it's pretty clear that that is what happens.
What's interesting is that our biology relies on us being in the midst, doesn't it? That, and that to us is stability, when in fact it's only process, right? And as long as a process keeps going, well, obviously we're happy because we're around, you know? And as you're saying, Amanda, these papers, and in a way, the ease of Hitler's advance, at least at the beginning of the war, laid bare that actually human affairs, like nature itself, as you say, are right on the point always. But collapse is A, imminently possible at any one moment, and human affairs too. are in process, and if one thing gets out of joint and lets in some other force, and we're seeing it, I think, today, and I don't need to get too obvious about that, but that's one of the reasons I think you guys are writing about precarity, by the way, is that we live in times that feel as though they've gotten out of control politically. I'm wondering, to you as a writer, that parallel, I mean, it makes my hair stand on end, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, me too. I mean, I said to my editor, you know, I'm writing this whole thing. It's about this one day in 1939. But I hope by the end of it, what the reader takes away is that this is the most precarious day in the universe, you know, that we're in it right now. And that the whole thing is sort of just like a metaphor for that. So I was trying to sort of do that without saying it. But that was exactly how I was feeling as I was writing it. It's like, I mean, on the one hand, it makes everything feel miraculous. And, you know, the fact that we're here at all and that you can find these points of stability where you get matter and people and society and everything is and stars, you know, all of that is so miraculous. So that's like the flip side of it. But there is this kind of underlying horror of, oh, this is like much less stable than we think. And one person like a Hitler character, you know, can throw it off if people don't push back enough. And
the countervailing forces.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. And even though something like a black hole is something that we can just stand there and watch, there's nothing we can do about it, and there's nothing we can do to stop it. The interesting thing about it is that the two earthbound parts of your day, the splitting of the atom and the start of war, are things that people have done. And the splitting of the atom specifically is like, why did we go in there and say, let's see if we can make this thing blow up? Let's just add another neutron in there and see. Oh, wow, look at the energy. Oh, my God. Oh, you know, and suddenly we're like, maybe we can't control this, but we started it. And that's kind of like the same thing of the war. You know, it's just, you can't control Hitler, but they started it. You know, they let him go. They let him do his thing. So, yeah, there's a little bit of that in there, too, of like, we started something that now we want to stop, and this is really going to be hard to stop.
Yeah. I mean, the wild thing to me, like just historically, was how quickly that happened too. I mean, there was the discovery of fission in the lab. So this was in Berlin, and maybe I'm forgetting the exact date, but maybe this was like a year before it, at most. And then you had Liza Meitner and her nephew sort of figuring out, you know, looking at this data from a lab and saying, I think they split the nucleus and, like, you know, calculating the energy. Niels Bohr finds out about this. He happens to be on his way to Princeton to talk to Einstein. He meets with Wheeler in Princeton. They start working on this. Well, how is that happening? What's the mechanism of fission? That's how, you know, they work on this paper. The paper comes out, and then, like, the Manhattan Project starts, and the bomb is... I mean, it's just the speed at which that discovery led to... So, like a, you know, a city being blown up is just unreal. And so even that alone, like, I mean, I guess only war makes things happen that quickly. But
what you're talking about, again, is that's yet another metaphor for this principle that we're exactly. talking about, where not for stability, but meta stability or whatever
yes,
you call it.
Yes.
Yet. So how meta stability, once just one part of the balance changes, you have an accelerating process.
Exactly.
Right. You know, and so you go from Niels Bohr's and Robert Oppenheimer's papers to Nagasaki and Hiroshima, as Don talks about, in 6 years. We can't think about the universe today the way we thought about it the last day of August in 1939.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I think I mean, there's something almost interesting about, you know, they put out this paper it's a public paper. It was in a journal. I mean, it's such dangerous information, you know, but at the same time, it was like, well, once physicists know this is possible, it wasn't a huge leap of the imagination to go from this kind of esoteric, you know, process in a nucleus to think of a bomb. Like that leap was not far, because it was sort of clear, oh, this process, you start it by hitting the thing with a neutron, but it's going to produce more neutrons. And that sort of chain reaction was pretty clear. And the idea of both bombs and nuclear reactors were both sort of obvious very quickly. And then it became like, well, we could choose not to do it, but then maybe the German physicists are working on it. And, you know, and they didn't know. And that was actually, you know, how they kept the Manhattan Project physicists really motivated is they kept telling them the Germans were very close, which turned out not to be true at all. Yeah, it's hard to, it's like once you know that this is possible, it's very hard to get everyone to sort of collectively say, okay, but we're not going to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it was like, once the cat was out of the bag.
Let's be virtuous instead.
Yeah.
Well, one of the stipulations of theory in science is that you have to be published, and somebody has to read what you've published and duplicate it in order to say, yeah, this is definitely something that is. And so, yeah, when you have a situation like this that's very precarious, do you really want that to happen? Do you really want the scientific method to continue?
Yeah. And interestingly, you know, Niels Bohr sort of tried to start this movement that he called open science or the open world. And he, you know, gave speeches and he talked to political leaders, and he really believed that the only way, you know, because there's sort of two ways you could have an impulse to go in that situation. One is like shut down, make everything top secret. But he sort of saw that as like understandable, but not the way to go, because then you're just putting everything in the hands of a few people. He just felt like knowledge has to be open and available to everybody. And then we can sort of create peace based on a kind of equality from the start. But that was like an interesting thing. You know, everybody had different reactions. Oppenheimer obviously felt really terrible about his role in all of this. And
sure. So did Truman, for that matter.
Yeah. Everyone had to kind of cope with the aftermath of that. And Wheeler, I mean, this is a whole other story, but he was mad at himself that they didn't build it quicker, and he went on to work on the hydrogen bomb. And part of the reason for that was that his younger brother was in the war. He was on the front lines. And he didn't know what Wheeler was working on because it was top secret, but he also kind of did. Like, he knew Wheeler had published this paper on fission. He knew he was working on a top secret thing. Like, he could kind of guess what was happening. And he sent Wheeler a postcard. This is the last Wheeler heard from his brother. It was a postcard, and all it said was, hurry up.
Oh, boy.
Wow.
And by the time they tested the bomb in Los Alamos, his brother had already been killed. And so Wheeler felt personally responsible that he didn't get it done fast enough, and that he could have saved his brother. He could have saved countless other soldiers. And so he just kind of, like, his guilt took him in this other direction, which was like, you know, we need the best weapons. And I mean, yeah, it's interesting how everyone reacts differently to these things. But
Auden himself regretted something that he wrote in that poem.
That's right.
Because his famous line, "We must love one another or die," which is the original line. First of all, for the moment, at least from where I sit, that's one of the great bravest lines anyone ever wrote, because he's basically saying, hey, we don't have any alternative. Even if we don't want to love, the other choice is unthinkable. And I'm sure that was part of what he wrote out of. But later he said, you know, I'm kind of telling a lie there, because even if we love one another, I mean, we're still mortal. So he changed it later to, we must love one another and die. And that seems really harsh to people, but he's trying to say, I think, that we must accept that the fact of our mortality. And I think that might make us love one another more if we actually did accept that, if we saw that this is the human, this is what's common to human beings, one of the many things that's common. And that should make us love one another in the first place. But so the parallels are so compelling. I mean, you must have known at some point, Amanda, that you had something really good in this essay.
I mean, yeah, all of it just blew me away. And in an early draft, I talked about Auden coming to that regret. And I described the bomb being dropped and sort of fission actually happening and the consequences of that. And a number of other things in the future. And then I sat with it for a while, and I was reading it, and I thought, no, I want to take all of this out. I just want to capture this precarious moment.
Of course. Yes.
I don't want any of the future stuff. So that was like a hard choice, just like from a writing perspective, because like I don't actually mention the bomb. I just sort of allude to it. But I really wanted to capture like where you don't yet know if this is going to go as badly as you think, because I also wanted it to be able to stand in for the moment we're in now, where we don't know how things are going to turn out. And so there's like a scene in the, you know, I went back through all these newspapers and I tried to find these moments to pull out for what was going on that same day and all the preparations that were being made for the war. And so there's a scene that I describe in the piece where in Danzig, which was this sort of autonomous city, but it was the post office, the rail system and the mail system were run by the Polish. And so when the German army started encroaching, they sort of locked down the post office as a kind of fortress, and they gathered all this ammunition. And I was trying to list, you know, the people that were there, including the caretaker and his 10-year-old daughter and, you know, all the people that were there that were. And if you look up this story, almost all of those people die by the end of that day. I think that the caretaker's daughter dies by the end of the week because she's captured. I mean, it goes terribly. But I didn't put any of that in the story. I just put the moment that the Nazis are like on their way. And they're just, so I kept trying to just keep it on that pencil point and not like let the story tip.
Yeah. And it's just incredibly interesting how things turned out and how they get worse before they got better in all of the different categories. And you know, in Auden's poem, he goes down and then he kind of tries to bring you back up a little bit at the end. Even if it's not entirely successful, even if he's not entirely convinced that this is going to happen, but the whole of the experience that you don't take people on when you don't go over that pencil tip is things get worse before they get better, and that's maybe something that again, as I said, deniability is a big part of how people deal with things, and when we're looking at the way things are right now, we really don't want to see things get any worse before they get better. But, you know, there's a good chance they will. Better than average.
Amanda, the last time we were talking about you and your writing about Putnam, this guy who may have come up with one of the best philosophical / scientific descriptions of what mind is. That's all. You know, one of the big conundrums.
No big deal, yeah.
No big deal here. You seem to seize on these stories that people don't know well enough, right? The people ought to know them. What are you working on now? Are you working on something else that's in this sort of ballpark?
Well, it's funny. Well, so I'm still very much working on Putnam because I am turning it into a book.
Yay!
so Putnam still occupies 90% of my day. But I do love these stories. There's something about either like forgotten moments or forgotten people that I just find like just irresistible as a writer.
So Amanda Gefter, we always, always go wonderful places with you. You know, we have these great conversations. The most precarious day in the universe. It's worth reading. It's more than worth reading. It's really worth thinking about. And thank you for coming on Musical Inner Tube again.
Thank you so much. This was so fun.
And thank you for listening to The Musical Inner Tube.
Send us an email at musicalinnertube, all one word, @gmail.com.
Or log in to our website, musicalinnertube.com, and click on the microphone in the lower right-hand corner to leave us a voicemail.
And while you're on our website, take a few minutes to listen to past episodes of the podcast, along with pictures and biographies of our guests, blog posts, and lots more.
Our thanks to virtual band Car Radio Dog for providing us with our theme music.